We have scrubbed the world clean of magic. Those are the words of the late... I'll say that again. We have scrubbed the world clean of magic. They're the words of the late Zen philosopher and Episcopal priest, Alan Watts. We have scrubbed the world clean of magic. Very poignant comment. Modern Western cultures, with their reliance on industry and mass production, technology, and excessive materialism, have essentially desacralized the world, taking the sense of magic and the wonder and the sacredness, the sense of sacredness, out of it, reducing everything to mechanical laws and even mechanistic social principles. We have in many ways been severed from the sense of connectedness to nature that our ancestors knew was vital to their lives. Romantic poet William Wordsworth, writing at the end of the monumental transition known as the Industrial Revolution, the time when rural societies in Europe and America became industrial and urban, Wordsworth lamented this transition in his famous sonnet, which I know you've heard, but I'd like to offer this morning. The world is too much with us, late and soon. Getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We have given our hearts away, a sordid boon. The sea that bares her bosom to the moon, the winds that will be howling at all hours, and are upgathered now like sleeping flowers. For this, for everything, we are out of tune. It moves us not. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan suckled in a creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasant lea, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn, have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn. Little we see in nature that is ours. If that was true in Wordsworth's time, it is so much more so today. This morning on my way to church, I walked up some concrete steps to my carport, got into my metal and plastic car, and drove down an 18-mile path of mostly concrete and tar roads and freeways. Then I walked across the tarred parking lot here and onto the concrete sidewalk into this building. Along the way, most of what I was seeing in my field of vision is part of a human-made environment. And although it's functional, it's certainly not very aesthetically satisfying or spiritually fulfilling, although the beautiful church grounds do provide some visual relief from all the concrete and tar. In his book titled In the Absence of the Sacred, Jerry Mander makes the point that we in our modern technological society spend most of our lives this way, insulated from nature, living, working, and often even recreating mainly in human-made environments. His worry is that we will continue to become an ever more isolated species, living in shells of our own making, and so separated from the natural world that we lose any sense of commitment to and reverence for nature. From such isolation, it is easier to continue to demolish and desecrate, desacralize nature, to pollute and pave over the world, continue to eliminate species at an alarming rate, and pull fossil fuels out of the ground by any means necessary, aggravating the global warming crisis we are now faced with. We are fortunate to have scientists among us who remind us in various ways that we are part of a complex and intricate web of life. For us Unitarian Universalists, it is a sacred web, named in our basic UU principles, the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Today's sermon, in celebration of the 46th anniversary of Earth Day, is actually the second part of a sermon I gave here with the same title about a year and a half ago. In that sermon, I described a particular natural phenomenon that illustrates how complex this web of existence is. That is the phenomenon called upwelling, or coastal upwelling. This involves a complex interrelationship of winds and the Earth's rotation, and these acting on just a few areas of the world, a few coastal regions of the world. And this process brings up vital nutrients from the ocean depths to feed about one-third of the world's fish and many marine mammals on that same chain. Today, I'd like to briefly mention just a couple of other illustrations of how the miraculous web of life works. One example is the interrelationship of redwoods, voles, and fungi. Up in California's northwest, where the old-growth redwoods still stand, there is a specific fungus that grows against the trees. Voles love to eat this fungus, and their eating it prevents the fungus from killing the trees. And the owls, also around there, like to eat the voles. And that in turn controls the vole population so they don't eat too much of the fungus, since the trees depend on some of the fungus to break down the nutrients in the soil and help extend their roots. So that's just one more example. Another complex relationship is the monarch butterfly and the milkweed plant. We have seen almost 2 years of the monarch life cycle right here on the church grounds. And last year, our children planted some more milkweed to encourage more monarchs to come here on their annual migration from wintering in Mexico. The monarch has traditionally laid its eggs only on milkweed plants that the hatched caterpillars then eat. Milkweed has poisons in it that make the caterpillars unappetizing to birds, and eating milkweed makes them colorful, so the birds avoid eating the bright and not very tasty, or bitter even, butterflies. And they learn quickly, if they try to eat one, that those bright ones are to be avoided. But in places where milkweed is disappearing, due mostly to herbicides used in farming, the monarchs have started laying their eggs elsewhere when they lay them at all. They depend so much on this milkweed. And the caterpillars there have lost the advantage of milkweed poison, as well as their characteristic bright color that tells the birds to stay away. As a result of the disappearing milkweed, only 10% of the original monarch numbers have survived. This dangerous decline has upset many people in the U.S. who have come to love this iconic little creature, the most well-known of America's butterflies. The solution here is plant milkweed. You can do it, and you can be part of the solution, as we did right here. I have a little handout that I've made copies of that's on the information table outside, and you can pick it up as you circulate and look at all of the materials relating to Earth Day. So if you can do it, plant some, and you'll be able to see that miracle unfold before your eyes year after year. And despite its name, milkweed is not an unattractive plant. In a book titled The Biophilia Hypothesis, several scientists put forward the hopeful idea that there may be some innate urge in the human species to focus on and connect in some way with other life forms, and that this tendency is still within us, even in our current alienation from nature. Perhaps this is why so many people have pets and cherish them, or they become hikers and bird watchers, or they visit parks or tend gardens. Although many of us are walled off from nature by concrete and plastic and steel, we still long for a connection with other living things. I remember that as a child, growing up in New York City, where trees grew out of little square spaces of dirt surrounded by concrete sidewalks, I felt so nature deprived that I created a fantasy world for myself as I walked the streets. I imagined that all the concrete sidewalks were paths into deep woods, and that the little trees encased in concrete and surrounded by tiny metal fences were actually big, beautiful trees in the wood. The cars I imagined as animals coming and going through these trees. There was one real, large, old willow tree down near the East River where I used to walk. It was my favorite. When a hurricane finally ripped it out of the ground and laid it unceremoniously across the sidewalk, I cried and cried. This, I think, is biophilia, something in our bones that connects with nature despite our being in human-made environments. What if by some magic metamorphosis we could bring the deep and for some unconscious connection to nature up into awareness and place it in the foreground? What if we could, as a society, strengthen and enlarge that part of ourselves that still longs for a spiritual connection with other living things? What if we could regain the kind of consciousness that the poet John Wright spoke of when he advised, "Every time you breathe in, thank a tree." Or the novelist Alice Walker spoke of through Shug, the character in The Color Purple, who says, "I knew that if I cut a tree, my arm would bleed." What if we could come to see the divine, not just symbolized by, but truly manifested in living things, as our ancestors did, and many indigenous cultures still do? Perhaps then we could, as a culture, leave off our obsessive getting and spending and begin to re-sacralize the living world and therefore treat it with the respect that sacred objects deserve. Celebrating Earth Day is one attempt to re-establish a conscious awareness of the link between nature and humanity, making such activities as environmental activism, conservation, and recycling sacred acts. From my window in Berkeley, I can see a lovely mountain that sits on the other side of the bay, San Bruno Mountain. It's distinctive. It kind of rises up from, and it rises up sort of improbably, as you think about it, from the urban sprawl that's all around its base. And from a distance, it looks like a large bear green or brown hump in the landscape, its color depending on the season. One year when I worked at the San Mateo Church near that mountain, I went up to a park on the mountainside, and there I read the various kiosks and learned that there are several species of plants and some butterflies that live on that mountain and that have been found nowhere else. This is often true in small areas all over the globe, which is just one reason why the rapid leveling of rainforests all over the world is so distressing. Literally thousands of species which took millennia to develop in a particular ecosystem are wiped out in a couple of weeks of cutting and burning. I became interested in the history and the ecology of this mountain, this prominent feature of the landscape that is the only significant stretch of undeveloped land in that area. Although in recent years its east face has been somewhat developed, I learned that back in 1965 there was a plan to extensively develop this mountain. As the developers at the time put it, they wanted to give the mountain a haircut. That is, they wanted to take down a significant portion of the mountain, 50 feet of it, to level it and then develop on it, and they wanted to use the soil for bayfill. At the time, Paul Gehrke, mayor of Brisbane, the little town that is nestled in the side of that mountain, had this to say about the development plan. The plan was to take down the mountain by conveyor belt over the freeway and over the Sierra Point dump. This is why saving the bay was important to saving the mountain and vice versa. Various groups, Save the Bay groups, Save the Mountain groups, got together to fight this. He said it all fits together. The barges were going to come in there and take away all that earth and fill up 10,000 acres of San Francisco Bay from Burlingame all the way down to Redwood City. 10,000 acres of the bay, he writes. And just think what this project's effect would have on the weather. The whole ecosystem of the bay area would be totally different, he said. The whole ecosystem, that and what was left of the mountain, he said, they were going to put 10,000 people on it. There would have been nothing left, and all the fog from Daly City would roll right on over. It all fits together, said the mayor. Take down a part of the mountain and fill up the bay, and you not only demolish natural beauty and irreplaceable species, but you fill up the space with yet more urban sprawl, and you change the very weather patterns of the whole area. The demolition of the rainforests worldwide has a detrimental effect on world rainfall, and global warming is already resulting, as you know, in major changes in the Earth's climate, reducing agricultural production at a time when the Earth's population is increasing at an alarming rate. It all does fit together. A rock, a river, a tree. Organic and inorganic matter on Earth and in the atmosphere form a complex interdependent web. And we are dangerously pulling out strands of the web one by one, weakening the structure. It is all driven by economics. A mountain left alone, a rainforest uncut, these do not generate profits, the bottom line. But the real bottom line for all of us is not the corporate bottom line, not profits. It's the environment. Ultimately, the fragility of the planet is a democratizing force. Everyone has to breathe the same polluted air. Even the corporate officials who want to dump pollutants into a river or disassemble a mountain. Everyone has to live with the consequences of overdevelopment, urban blight, pollution, and the tragic loss of species. Within today's environmental crisis, however, there are signs of hope. We are slowly realizing in little communities here and there, and even on a world scale, that we are ultimately physically interdependent Deep interconnections are becoming more obvious. For instance, the can of hairspray manufactured with chlorofluorocarbons, it's a mouthful, that can of hairspray that I used, say, 40 years ago, contributed to the hole in the protective ozone layer in the Earth's atmosphere, and that in turn jeopardized my survival, making me more vulnerable to skin cancer. This interconnectedness was acknowledged in the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio. During that summit and in other international accords, nations actually came together and agreed to the reduction and eventual elimination of the manufacture of chlorofluorocarbons and other chemicals which have damaged the ozone layer. The good news is that the ozone layer is recovering. Estimates are that it will take another 50 or so years for the ozone to return to the level it was at before we used products that were destroying it. It's amazing to me that we even can bring something we've damaged back to natural levels. To me, that's a hopeful sign. And on Earth Day, this past Friday, the world's two biggest contributors to global warming, that would be the U.S. and China, along with around 170 other nations, signed the Paris Agreement, which was worked out among 195 nations last December at a United Nations Convention on Climate Change. This agreement aims to keep global temperature, the rise of global temperature, below 2 degrees Celsius in this century, with further measures which can keep it to no more than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. Keeping temperature rise at this level gives the world a fighting chance, a defense against the worst consequences of global warming. A lot more needs to be done, but this is a step in the right direction. Many local projects offer hope as well. Some 50 years ago, when citizens realized that by taking down San Bruno Mountain and filling up the bay shore with the soil, they would be losing a beautiful natural habitat and changing the bay's ecosystem, they worked together to stop this massive project. And years later, activists and Ohlone Indians worked together to preserve a 5,000-year-old Native American village, shell mound, and burial site that's on the mountain. It's the largest and oldest such site in the Bay Area. And that was another development plan that they saved the village from. Thankfully, today, I can still see the mountain from my window, and we can all go and walk its paths and enjoy its beauty. Although there has been development on the mountain, as I said, it has been contained, thanks to the efforts of many activists over many years. As the poet Mae Sarton has said, never doubt that a small group of citizens can change the world. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has. We humans have evolved over millions of years into unique, self-aware beings who can contemplate the meaning of existence, who are aware of our own mortality, who can love or hate, who can be filled with awe or apathy, who can make choices about how to behave toward others, and who are now beginning to understand that what we do to the delicate strands of the interdependent web can affect the whole. A great and complex chain of events has led to us being here and being what we are in all our brutality and nobility. Who can say what role we humans may play in the future of the planet? Perhaps now, as small groups, as larger communities, and as nations, we will begin to reverse the trends, begin to save and protect what is left, and in the process, save ourselves. It is not too late. These closing words are excerpts, further excerpts from the poem by Maya Angelou. Lift up your eyes upon this day breaking for you. Give birth again to the dream. Here on the pulse of this fine day, you may have the courage to look up and out and upon me, the rock, the river, the tree, your country. Here on the pulse of this new day, you may have the grace to look up and out and into your sister's eyes and into your brother's face, your country, and say simply, very simply, with hope, good morning.